So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety. Welcome to another episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. I'm Nate Larkin.
I'm David Hampton.
David, my friend, spring has sprung in Middle Tennessee.
It has sprung, and it's staying sprung a little bit more now for longer stretches.
I have been working in my yard. We get done here today. I'll go home, fire up my brand new cordless electric lawnmower.
Is it solar power or just electric? Is it?
Yeah, it's electric. It's like it has about 18 minutes of battery power. So I got to really go fast.
You got to haul ass while you're.
But I'm gonna seed the lawn today before the rain comes. It's supposed to rain later on today.
Yeah, well, that'd be a good time, though. Get it all packed down nicely.
I don't know about you, but I find it easier to stay sober. Not that staying sober is a huge struggle all the time, but I feel like I'm I don't know. I do recovery a hell of a lot better when the weather's nice.
Yeah, and with a little bit of nature. You know, that's one of the things. I live in the city. I live downtown in a building. Yeah.
It is good to live in a building.
It is good to live in a building. I think it beats out under the bench, you know, for sure. But I don't have my landscaping is like I have three pots on my balcony, and that's the extent of my landscaping. But I've got a friend that has a place at the lake, and I helped him actually build a flower bed last weekend.
Oh, you got your hands in the dirt?
I guess that's what they call it. I was dirty.
Yeah.
We hauled stones and we hauled bags of dirt and we stacked and we shaped and we even put a little water feature in, and it was pretty nice. So we were very proud of it when we got done.
But. And doesn't it feel good to get outside? Get some physical exertion, do a little bit of exercise.
Oh, yeah.
Get some sun on your skin, a little vitamin D, a little light in the eyes.
And I was surprised at how quiet it is when you get away from the city and you're in nature.
Yeah.
You know, you're in a kind of a natural environment because, you know, when I came home, my place felt like Times Square.
Sure.
Sirens and trains and cars and you know, all of that. But yeah, it is. It's you get outside and you breathe air and just something happens and there's some perspective that comes with that.
I think. Well, I think that maybe then, for the sake of my sobriety, I need to become. I think I just need to roam around the globe, staying in perpetual spring. Just follow the sun.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the human sundial or something.
Yeah. Golly, if that were just possible.
Yeah.
But it does feel, it just feels so good to be able to go outside now without putting a jacket on. My morning walks with my friends, I take a walk every morning with at least one guy.
Yeah.
Just to breathe the air. I'm really grateful for this season.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand we will have some listeners who are on the, you know, in the Southern Hemisphere, and for them, they're heading into fall and winter, and it's dark, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
My condolences.
Yes, pray you through the darkness.
Yeah. I like the longer days, too.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
So much easier to get up in the morning with the sun shining through the window.
than to have to fumble for a flashlight or something to make it to the stairs.
And when I leave my office, often it's, you know, 6 or 6:30 in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And just for there to be sun when I walk out of the building is great because, you know, in the winter it felt like I got to work it in the dark and I left in the dark. And
yeah,
it was just like, I don't know, working in the North Pole.
I do know this, though, that in the summer, especially these long, languorous, delicious evenings, I do have to push myself to go to a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Easier to go to the meeting when it's dark and miserable and I know that I need a meeting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But on a, you know, on a magical summer evening, I can find lots of reasons for not getting in the room and sitting in the chairs for an hour.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of my real meetings is my church at St. Augustine's does a recovery Eucharist at 8 a.m. and on Sunday mornings.
Right.
And that is basically a recovery meeting. We sit in circle, we share, we have the readings, we do all of that. We just happen to have the Eucharist at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I love about that is I don't sacrifice an evening in order to do it, because I could do my Sunday morning thing and kind of, and then if I do go to church, like big church we used to call it, then I've killed two birds with one stone, and there it is.
Yeah.
And it gives me my spring schedule.
Well, and I'm grateful now that I've got the option of virtual meetings through the Samson Society.
Yes.
So when we finish up here, I'll be going home to host the Thursday noon meeting.
Which is a very cool thing.
Yeah. So we got guys signing on really from all around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
And we can have a one-hour conversation, but it'll be indoors. I suppose I could probably take the laptop outside and do it outdoors.
Take
do it on
to the
front
porch. Yeah.
Ooh, there's an idea.
You've got some furniture set up out there, and
there you go. All right. Well, my day's filling up here. I'm going to mow the lawn. I'm going to seed the lawn. I'm going to do the virtual meeting out on the porch. There we go.
Well, let's get to it.
Yeah. Well, we have a great guest today.
We do.
I have just finished her book, A Sky for Us Alone.
Yes.
I suppose it maybe is targeted a little bit toward, not young readers, but anyway.
I think it's a young adult imprint on HarperCollins.
Yeah.
Catherine Teagan books.
But I enjoyed it very much.
Yes.
Really did.
Yeah.
So we'll be back with that very fascinating author in a moment here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And we have a charming, brilliant, wonderful guest with us today.
We do.
Why don't you do the honors of the introduction, since you go way back with this woman?
Well, Kristen Russell, that I knew as Kristen Smith, mm-hmm. growing up, and actually I was grown up, she was growing up, and I worked with Kristen's dad, Scotty Smith, at Christ Community Church for about 20 years, and watched his family and his influence in Nashville and Franklin just change the way a lot of people do church now. Yeah. And so it's really great to just have Kristen as a guest today and talk about her endeavors that she's using her own story and her own gifts and some newly discovered, or maybe they're not newly discovered, Krista, mm-hmm. we could talk about that, but certainly new to bringing them to the rest of the world as a writer mm-hmm. and as story as a recovering person.
Yeah.
And
so Kristen, you grew up a preacher's kid.
I sure did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And not just a preacher's kid, but your dad, in this part of the country at least, was a superstar preacher.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, he really was.
Yeah. So, and you've got one brother, so just the two of you?
Okay. Just the two of us, yeah.
So what was it like growing up in the fishbowl?
Yeah, it was a really interesting way to grow up,
mm-hmm.
for sure. you know, the church the dad ended up planting, Christ Community, mm-hmm. was big. It ended up being really large.
Right. Yeah.
Up to that point, we probably didn't feel the effects so much, mm-hmm. Just because the churches weren't as big, and honestly, we didn't know any other thing.
Right.
You know, that was just what our dad did. It was
right.
like going to whatever job. Uh-huh. But when he planted Christ Community, I was about 11 years old, and the church was so linked to the Christian music industry, mm-hmm. That, you know, it was just a whole different thing at that
yeah.
point.
Yeah.
Because then we were going backstage to concerts, and we were on tour buses, and those kinds of things just became sort of a norm. You know, a lot of my
sure.
friends became musicians, and it just, the bigger the church got, and Nashville was still pretty small at the time too.
Right? Yeah, yeah, right.
So
right.
Before
was,
the boom.
Right.
Yeah.
It was before the boom. So, you know, we really couldn't go hardly anywhere without people going, oh, we know who your dad is.
Sure.
And yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you went behind the scenes in the whole Christian music industry. You saw how the sausage is made,
yeah.
right?
Yes, yes. I've been in a lot of sausage factories.
Yeah.
yeah. Wow, what a way to grow up. So how did that influence you? Were you the compliant kid or the rebellious kid? How did you find your way?
I was kind of both.
Really?
Honestly, I was compliant in terms of school and academics. Mm-hmm. I always did well in school. I started to get a little bit of a rebellious nature when I was a teenager, but mm-hmm. it wasn't with substances or anything like that. It
right.
was more of just my spirit became a little bit more defiant.
Right, mm. yeah.
And I was always creative.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that always made me feel like a little bit of the weird kid too.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I was, when growing up, I was climbing trees and going to creeks and, you know, mm-hmm. reading stories and mm-hmm. Just really happy to spend time in my imagination. So that's always been an aspect of my personality. I don't think my preacher's kid stereotypical rebellion really came into play until different periods of my adult life.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of searching for, realizing, you know, do I really know who I am mm-hmm. outside of this context?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you've had that your whole life and you're trying to get to know yourself outside of it, it can, you know, can be a bit disorienting for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. I was telling you, Kristen, a little bit earlier before we started that your dad had such an influence on me in so many ways and how much I still love and respect Scotty and Miss kind of the weekly encounters that he and I used to have.
Yeah.
And he told me once that he sees himself as an introvert with extroverted gifts.
Yeah.
And always thought that was a really great way to describe
mm-hmm.
him.
Mm-hmm.
But are you a more introverted person? Do you prefer the very small thing to really being out there?
Yes, 100% yes. I'm definitely an introvert. Every Myers-Briggs at every point in my life that I've ever taken, the I is always strongly, strongly there.
Yeah,
yeah.
So, yeah, I am. I really enjoy, you know, deep, meaningful conversation with one, two people, a small group of people. If I'm at a party, I tend to, you know, kind of be one of those people that finds a smaller group or usually lands in the kitchen, that
mm-hmm.
kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you majored in literature, is that right?
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I graduated from Belmont University with
right.
a major in English literature.
But then your career took a turn.
Yeah.
And you ended up in cosmetology?
Yes.
And
yeah, you can imagine. It was maybe a year after I graduated, a year and a half, from Belmont, and I told my parents, and they had paid for my college.
at
know,
Belmont.
Right, at Belmont University.
Just add that.
Yeah, and I said, you know, I think I want to go to cosmetology school now.
Uh-huh.
And they, at the time, then also, that was still thought of as kind of like a, you know, not, uh-huh. it's not something that people who have been to college do.
Uh-huh.
That was a bias and a judgment,
uh-huh.
I think. that now, you know, there are so many successful hairstylists and people in different forms of fashion. But at that time, it was kind of like, what are you going to go work at, like a little beauty shop? You know, what are you what do you want to do with that? But I was also a studio art minor in college. And to me, it was just a great way to have instant gratification with an artistic endeavor and a way that I knew I could make really great money, honestly. So
yeah, well, and that's true. I mean, I think that that's something, like you said, that's a kind of a stereotype that maybe many people that don't know that world have. My daughter did cosmetology for a very brief time as well, and the potential to do that and do well at it is certainly, and in an entertainment community like Nashville, you know, is a great thing.
So I do have to ask.
Yeah.
By the way, we're going to get to your book, and you've written you've written a wonderful novel.
Thank you so much.
That is, it's a love story, and yet it's a mystery, and it's dark, and it's bloody, and it's beautiful. There's an awful lot of emotion and experience wrapped up in that story, which didn't come out of nowhere. It could not have come out of nowhere.
Right.
So I'm wondering, Kristen, did you eventually take a walk on the wild side yourself?
Oh, well, you mean in terms of themes of the book?
No, no, in your own personal life. In other words, have you drawn it all on personal experience in telling the stories of Harlow and Tennessee and all those characters in your book?
Well, the book touches a lot on the opioid crisis, as well as, I think you mentioned, violence and a lot of generational poverty and how you get out of those cycles. This is a crazy thing. When I was writing the book, I had no idea that I actually did have an addiction. I had a doctor prescribe Klonopin to help me sleep, and I was on it for a total of 4.5 years. And right before I started the revision process, so after I got my book deal, I just said, you know, I really don't want to be taking anything that's going to cloud my thinking at all.
Yeah.
And I guess my intuition was telling me at that point that that was a possibility. I had no idea what was going on. And so I thought, I can just quit taking this. You know, I'll switch to melatonin. It'll be as simple as that. And so I did that, and I still didn't, you know, I thought I was just having like some really bad days. like just really out of the blue, you know, just bad days. And then I started researching. And I realized that I was in fact addicted to a drug, and that getting off of it was going to be a really hard, complicated process.
Can you tell us what a bad day for you might have looked like?
Well, at the beginning, it really just felt like, you know, I'm just feeling like extra emotional and moody, and my sleep definitely was the first thing to be affected, because that's what I was primarily taking it for. I wasn't taking it for panic attacks and that kind of thing, although later I wished that I could take it for panic attacks. So those were, my sleep and my mood were the first things that were affected. After my taper, during and after my taper, it was such a wide range of horrible symptoms, of just from physical, mental, emotional. It was the whole gamut of having to pull my brain off of a substance and then really just allow it and give it the time that it needed to heal. And that was really what I found was the only true thing that was, you know, that was the only way I was really going to feel better.
And you discovered this in the at the during the timeline of writing the book, during the editing process?
Yes. So with publishing, you get a book deal, especially if it's your first book, you get a book deal, and then you begin a revision process, which is you're working with your editor to change everything from the structure and plot of the book to, you know, the smaller things like the actual writing. But my revisions were pretty major. So there was a lot of work ahead of me, and there was a lot of work to be done while I was feeling, honestly, my worst. The worst I'd ever felt in my life.
And so what was like the holy crap moment for you in drawing this conclusion that I'm dealing with this stuff that I've been writing about for months, you know, and now in this editing process, I'm discovering this about me.
Yeah.
How did that get kind of reconciled?
It was so hard to see that I had gone and researched this region in Appalachia with the mindset of, oh, these people, I'm so glad that this isn't my life. And in terms of poverty and, you know, the things that are, that's, I have so much to be incredibly grateful for in my life. I'm so blessed in so many ways. Mm-hmm. But when I realized that I had an addiction, I'd been writing about an addiction. One, I think as writers, we have to be honest about the fact that most of what ends up on the page, even if it's in the shape of a different character or events, nothing in my book, A Sky for Us Alone, is actually autobiographical. Mm-hmm. But also at the same time, everything is autobiographical.
Right.
Because it's a composite of every experience that I've ever had, mm-hmm. including the research I did for the book. Mm-hmm. So when I found out that I had an addiction, I was shocked, extremely humbled. Also, there was a part of me that said, "I maybe this book is my subconscious trying to save me."
Mm. Wow. That's a pretty big realization to come to. I think it was Stephen King that said that in writing fiction, that the characters almost write the book, or he said something to that effect, like the characters tell you when you begin to get to know these people mm-hmm. that you're sort of inventing, that they sort of write the book or tell the story. Did you have that experience? Did you feel like the characters began to tell you the story, or was that just...
Yeah, in a lot of ways. I think, and now that I've started my next book, I've found that when their writing is really jiving, it's when I have the characters there first and they start talking to me. Mm-hmm. That's when I know that there's potential for a real story to happen. Mm-hmm. Because if I'm trying to force it, if I'm just trying to plot and then make the characters fit into the plot, mm-hmm. that doesn't... It just doesn't seem to come from my heart. There are plenty of writers who write that way mm-hmm. with plotting first and then character development later.
Yeah.
But I really love story that flows from characters. And I'm also always going to be interested in some form of redemption for the mm-hmm. characters. Mm-hmm. That's always going to be something that I'm interested in writing about.
Yeah.
And, you know, with Stephen King, The Shining was really about his alcoholism. Mm. That character in The Shining was so the crazy writer who's just losing his mind and losing his shit.
Yeah.
And that was the book that really brought him to deal with his own alcoholism.
Right, right. Kristen's book is A Sky for Us Alone. It's on HarperCollins, Teagan Books.
Catherine Teagan
yeah. imprint. Mm-hmm. And how did you land on this subject matter? Coming as a kid that grew up in a pretty, conservative area of the country, Williamson County is the wealthiest county in Tennessee.
Yeah.
You came through some pretty good schools and mm-hmm. some pretty good circles of friends.
Yeah.
And you take your first published work into Appalachia and the opioid epidemic and poverty and murder mysteries and feuding families and mm-hmm. all this. So where'd you get that?
Yeah. Well, both of my parents are from North Carolina. Uh-huh. So we grew up going to the mountains every year. Mm-hmm. And we had a close family friend who had a condo at Sugar Mountain in Boone, North Carolina.
Yeah.
And we went there every year. And we would go there, which this kind of fits into the book too. We would go there to take a break from some crazy relatives, basically. It was kind of this safe place where we could go and not have to stay with relatives the whole time. Mm-hmm. And we could have just some separate time for our family. And so I've always loved the mountains. The mountains are in my blood mm-hmm. for sure. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Appalachian State my first semester of college before I went to Belmont. So I spent a lot of time in Boone. and driving the Blue Ridge Parkway, and I love that landscape so much. But I remember even as a kid, we would stay at Sugar Mountain, and then just a mile or two from there, we would drive, and I would see, you know, the trailers with all the stuff mm-hmm. in front of the houses, yeah. and 10 cars that most of them are pulled apart, and I just, even as a child, thought, how can that look so different just a mile from what's over here? Mm-hmm. So even as a kid, that culture was fascinating to me, you know, the decay in the midst of this really beautiful landscape.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I'd like to ask you some more about writing, especially as it relates to your own, you know, the maintenance of your personal peace and sanity.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first pieces of instruction that I was given when I entered recovery 20 years ago was to start writing every day,
mm-hmm.
to begin journaling, to put pen to paper. I was used to writing for a living, writing stuff that nobody would read, technical stuff, but writing for me was a new thing. And I was inclined only to write when I felt inspired to do so.
Yeah.
And those, you know, winds of inspiration were very unpredictable.
Uh-huh.
What I was instructed to do was write anyway. Put pen to paper, sit down, and freaking write. Tell the truth on paper.
Yeah.
And I suppose that is, you know, if you're going to write for a living, having now completed a couple books myself, I know if you're actually going to complete a book and honor the contract and meet the deadline, you got to write whether you feel like it or not. And I have found personally that much like going to the gym, I might have dragged my ass to the gym,
mm-hmm.
But I gain energy by expending energy.
Yeah.
I feel better when I left than when I started.
Yeah.
That tends to be the same for me with writing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big part of a positive life for me these days, for positive sobriety. Is that how does your experience contrast or mesh with mine?
Yeah, I agree with everything that you've said. There are certainly a whole lot of days that I don't feel like writing, and there are a lot of days, honestly, that I don't write unless I'm working specifically on a project. I would love to get to the point that I'm writing whether, you know, there's a book idea there or not.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe in the practice of writing, because I found that when I'm not writing, I really start to feel out of whack.
Yeah.
I start to feel out of balance and just not like I'm my best self.
Yes.
You know? Mm-hmm. And I think that, and that might really be the definition of what a writer is. It's just that you have to write.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I definitely came up against a lot of different obstacles from the time that I decided to start learning the process of how to write a novel. And people ask me that a lot, you know, how do you get from there to here? And I really think it's that. It's just, you're going to keep writing no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not for everybody.
Sure.
You know? So you're a writer. I'm a writer. Mm-hmm. That's just what we do.
Yeah. Mm.
And if we stop, then, you know, I don't think that makes us not writers. But I think the need to develop, and I feel like I know myself best. I feel like I'm doing what I was made to do
mm-hmm.
when I'm writing.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, me too. And there's something therapeutic and illuminating about putting heart and mind on paper.
Yeah.
It can stay pretty nebulous if it just stays between my ears.
Right.
I don't have to get clarity on it. But when you've got to form it into letters and put it on lines, it gets a little clearer.
I find that you also learn what you really think.
Yeah.
A little bit more. Mm-hmm. You know, because things can be kind of disconnected in my mind anyway before I sit down and write, and then when I put them together, I'm going, you know, oh shit, this is what I really may really believe about this. This may really be true. This may really be what's going on. And I didn't know that before the ghost you know, took over and really I had the experience of putting it down. So
I got to tell you, your book threw me in the first few pages. First of all, I mean, it starts with quite a bang.
Yes, it does.
But I came, because I knew you had written it, and it's written in first person, so mm-hmm. it's narrated by a lead character, mm-hmm. I assumed that Harlow was a girl.
Mm, right.
And a few pages in, oh no, this is a guy. And then I'm thinking, and you write quite convincingly as a boy. You pulled that off. Was that a stretch?
You know, it...
Because he gets a girlfriend and the whole deal.
Oh, right. Yeah, I know. No, I mean, honestly, it was kind of, it was fun. I don't know if I started the very first draft in first person or third person.
Uh-huh.
I think it's always been first person. And I think it just kind of felt, when I, at the very beginning, it just kind of felt like a fun dare. You know, I mean, that's what we do a lot of times as writers, is just step into this person's shoes. And, you know, a teenage boy in Appalachia, that was quite a dare for me. But at the same time, I was a tomboy growing up. Like I said, I was climbing trees and, you know, I was in creeks and all those kinds of things. So,
boy, I got to hand it. I would never even dare to write as a girl. I don't think I could pull it off.
Well, that's a great writing exercise for you. You know, because it might make you just open something up. Because I think empathy is, you know, that's the bottom line.
And you're a mom, too, and you have a boy. How old is Finn?
He is almost 10 now.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
But he was 2 when I started this book.
Really?
Wow. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it tells me you get boys. I mean, because you write convincingly as Harlow, and so it sounds like Finn's a pretty lucky person. Lucky boy to have a mom.
I'm a lucky mom for sure. He's pretty great.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Wow.
Well, the book again is called
A Sky for Us Alone.
A Sky for Us Alone. I love the cover art too, by the way.
I do too.
Really, really nice.
Yeah, they hired a graphic designer to do that outside of the company, and I was really happy with their choice. I was really scared that they were going to put something flowery on it. And I've heard a lot of authors say they didn't love their covers. And you can have some say in that, but ultimately, you know, they're going to choose. And so I was so happy with their choice and that they, you know, it's beautiful, but I feel like it also captures some of the darkness and suspicion and mystery of the book, which I really like.
I had a question, Kristen, about, you know, the editing process is tricky because I've written a couple of books and that handing it over to the editor and then getting...
I always hand over a perfect draft.
Yeah, oh gosh.
Of course.
Lucky you.
They have the audacity to improve it.
It's like letting somebody else raise your children after... like, you know, you have this idea and then somebody comes back and says, you know, you could cut out like this page and a half because it's like redundant and you've said this to death, and or, you know, I don't know what you mean here, and or this isn't clear, or this is inconsistent with whatever. And so the editing process is brutal at times. I mean, it can be really like you're either at odds or you're thinking, well, maybe, or I just suck, I shouldn't write ever again, or I'm imposing all this as me on you. But you're getting sober during the editing process.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking that's like two hells. So, you know, so was it?
It was really interesting. I mean, I learned so much about, you know, brain plasticity and healing and all that stuff during that time, for sure. And it was not easy because I knew that I was absolutely my most sensitive, and I'm already a sensitive person. So then, you know, to like be exponentially more sensitive while I'm having to look at, you know, criticism that's meant to help me, but it's still criticism. So yeah, there was a lot of deep breathing, a lot of pacing, a lot of just, but I will say it never, you know, I feel so grateful to have the opportunity to be able to write at this level and to also be able to write for young adults because it's such a great forum to have a message.
Yeah.
So I was really aware, even though I was going through a lot of, you know, just personal and physical pain, really, it was another point where I felt like the book was probably saving me. And it was another motivation to take care of myself the best that I could and to just continue because the opportunity was so great.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me ask you this. To our listeners who may have been told by friends and family, you should write a book, or who teased, you know, played with the idea in the past of maybe writing, if only for their kids and grandkids, what advice would you give to somebody who's considering stepping into the whole enterprise of writing?
I think I would just say try it and see if you want to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Because ultimately there are points where I think every writer says, I don't know if I can keep going. Mm-hmm. But again, it's just that you do. It's that you can't not do it.
Yeah.
And if you're going to write a book, nobody can really convince you to do it because it takes so much self-discipline and work and motivation to really complete any kind of book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you really want and love it, you're going to keep doing it. But it's great to have encouragement from people, you mm-hmm. know, and if the encouragement is enough to light the fire and get you going, and then you find that it becomes a love, that's awesome and incredible. And it's such a great journey to find something like that you love.
Okay.
Have you found your recovery, Kristen, to have changed your approach to writing or what you write or how you write?
I think recovery changes everything.
Well, sure. Yeah, exactly, for sure.
So, you know, my brain is different than it was before I went through recovery. I would love to see an actual image of my brain, you know.
Yeah, like a brain
from
map.
Now. Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah, from now and then. So I'm sure that it has changed a lot of things to do with the writing as well. I think that really, I mean, the whole process has been, again, like I just felt like this gift was handed to me, and then at the same time, I had an obstacle handed to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so those things are, I think, both of those things can sharpen us in ways that are completely unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm probably just more grateful for, one, the healing of my brain, mm-hmm. and two, for the ability to write and that people actually want to read what I write. I think there's just more gratitude in mm-hmm. general.
Yeah. And do you find, I mean, you were expressing some gratitude earlier, you know, just about realizing that you have had a very blessed, in many ways, life.
Yeah.
Do you have any practices now that you didn't have before in recovery to remind yourself of, you know,
yeah.
I am as fortunate as I am.
Yeah. I started meditating a lot uh-huh. during that time. And now, and really for Klonopin, with Klonopin for me, that recovery process has been so much longer. I mean, I'm the end of next month, it'll be 2 years for me.
Wow.
And in many ways, I feel like my brain is just now starting to feel mm-hmm. normalized again. But at the very worst of it, I was listening to a lot of podcasts by a woman named Tara Brach, who is a Buddhist and a psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
And so those were really helpful to me in just learning how to calm my mind when it mm-hmm. felt like it was going all over the place and, you know, learning about how we can deal with the amygdala and the fight or flight
mm-hmm.
and just things that we can actually do to train and grow our brains differently.
Mm-hmm.
Those have been really helpful for me. Also, you know, prayer, you know, just help.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, just yeah. to help.
Yeah, yeah. Is it Anne Lamott that says that's the most honest prayer you can pray, or
right.
something?
Yeah.
Just help.
Right. Yeah, I think that's kind of
pretty.
Yeah, that's sort of what my faith comes down to a lot of times.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh shit, help.
yeah. yeah.
So exactly. those things combined, my faith along with learning about Buddhist meditation and science too.
Yeah.
All of those things combined have been really helpful.
Yeah. I do some work with treatment centers that focus a lot on mindfulness and meditation and Eastern ideology in the mm-hmm. whole process of surrendering for what we would call the recovery resistant.
Yeah.
You know, because so much of so many of us in this part of the country come from certain ideologies and very, you know, straight, narrow ideologies. And when you can really broaden that experience out, you can surrender in new ways that you maybe didn't as a person.
Yeah, and that was definitely, of course, outside of the way that I grew up. Mm-hmm. And I think it took a while for me to get comfortable with the idea, you know, that there could be things from different places and thought systems and belief systems that could still be really helpful to me. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely been a big piece of just my own personal spiritual journey, is dropping that black and white fear mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. it has to look this way or it's wrong. Exactly. I can't do that anymore.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. This may be a weird question, and I know I'm kind of going all over the roadmap here, but it occurred to me a minute ago. Do you have a favorite character?
Yes, I do. That's funny. Somebody asked me that the other day. Yeah, my favorite character is Mama John.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, she's my favorite.
Yeah, she's kind of the embodiment of grace, isn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she's not perfect at all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love that about her. But I think we all wish that we had somebody like her mm-hmm. in our lives, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Kristen, this has been a very enjoyable conversation. Thank you for sticking with it and writing the book, finishing the book, seeing it through, creating that story, going through all the difficult phases of editing to get it in its final form.
Yeah.
And you're working on another story now?
I am.
Did you get a multi-book deal when you signed?
My publisher has option for the next one.
Okay.
And they've said that they want me to stay. So I have a synopsis out to my editor right now. And
okay.
So we'll see what she says
about
the next idea.
Yeah. Any chance that A Sky for Us Alone could be a movie?
You know, people, that, let's all pray that happens.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking it could be a very, you know, a really compelling, you know.
Yeah, I would love to see it as a movie. And really, from the beginning, people have asked that question. Mm-hmm. So I would love for it to land in the right director's hands. I really think in terms of movies when I'm writing, too. Mm-hmm. So I would absolutely love it.
There's all kinds of potential for picturesque, beautiful, and graphic, and
yeah.
You know, surprise and all that stuff. So that'd be a cool thing.
It'd be great, for sure.
We'd love to see it.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. Well, thanks again, Kristen. And
thanks for having me.
We're eager for the next book.
Yeah.
We'll be right back. Stay with us here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
Welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And Nate, that was a great conversation with Kristen. We had, you know, as writers, we could probably sit and talk about writing as much as we could recovery.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And just hearing her process. But I'm still back on the fact that her editing process was during her recovery.
Yeah, withdrawal from
Klonopin. Early recovery, yes.
Whoa!
Yeah, I was just like, holy crap. You know, if you could have scheduled a dermabrasion during that to go along with it, you'd had, you know, I mean, is there anything that could have made that any harder?
Oh, my. It's hard enough to take criticism.
Yeah.
Even well-intentioned criticism.
Right.
But to do it while your brain is trying to withdraw from something as powerful as Klonopin.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the interesting thing, you know, about withdrawal and the brain healing and recalibrating is that everything doesn't always fall in its proper receptacle.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so things can land on us in ways that maybe on our best day a year from now, it wouldn't.
Sure.
And so, you know, that was a brave undertaking for her. But just the way she tackled that culture and that subject, and I think the way she's going to steward her own story through this process is going to be really powerful.
you know, as somebody who grew up around a lot of poverty, and I've spent plenty of time in trailers, she wrote very convincingly about that life.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful story.
Yeah.
Well, we've got more visits coming up. The calendar's filling up with interesting guests.
It is.
Yeah. So I guess we'll meet back here again next week with Rex, our fearless, highly talented, unbelievably productive producer in the back who kind of makes it all sound good.
Exactly.
We'll be here a week from today with another episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Until then, I'm Nate.
I'm David.
And we are your pals on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelli, music by Rex Schnelli, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.